I am Bob Onder. I, too, am a candidate for the 9th Congressional District in the Republican primary. I am a state legislator. I serve the people of the 13th District. That's in St. Charles, a little bit of Warren County. When I'm not in the legislature, I am a medical doctor. I also am a licensed attorney. And my wife and I live with our 6 children in St. Charles County. This session, on January 22nd, I filed House Bill 1831. I filed it on January 22nd, the 35th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. Roe versus Wade is the infamous Supreme Court decision that essentially legalized abortion on demand, striking down the laws of all 50 states on the subject of abortion. Since that time, over 43 million unborn children have perished by abortion. Joseph Stalin once very cynically remarked that one man's death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. Well, I've lived most of my life in the shadow of Roe versus Wade, and it is still not a statistic to me that there is such massive loss of innocent human life in our country. Today, Roe versus Wade still stands, but over the past 15 years, a series of cases, Supreme Court cases, have affirmed that there are certain things, certain regulations of abortion, that do pass constitutional muster, and that particularly laws in the area of informed consent can be constitutional if crafted in a way as to not impose an unreasonable burden on the Supreme Court declared right of a woman to choose abortion. The seminal case here is Planned Parenthood versus Casey. This was a Pennsylvania case, of course, that held that the state's interest in life, even in very early pregnancy, allowed the state to require that certain elements of informed consent be required. These are elements that are incorporated into my bill, include the nature of the procedure, the health risks to the woman, the gestational age of the child, the development of the unborn child, and information about medical assistance that might be available, alternatives to abortion, the availability of child support, and the fact that there are various agencies willing to assist a woman with an unwanted pregnancy who wishes to put her baby up for adoption. Each of these provisions, again, is contained in House Bill 1831, along with a requirement that a woman be offered the option of having an ultrasound and viewing that ultrasound prior to the abortion. The Casey decision also upheld a one-day reflection period prior to an abortion. That's been part of Missouri law since 2003. The second part of my bill deals with the issue of coerced abortion. Now, I don't believe that it should be necessary to have a law to make it illegal to coerce a woman into having an abortion. But then again, in an ideal world, maybe it wouldn't be necessary to have a law against murder or rape or arson or assault. Unfortunately, too many women are coerced into having abortions. In one study, 70% of women felt that they were forced or coerced into having an abortion, that they had no choice. A recent Washington Post article covered a lawsuit filed by 3 Washington, D.C. paramedics who were forced to have abortions as a condition of keeping their jobs. A May 2007 article by ESPN reported that 7 Clemson student athletes had abortions because they were threatened with loss of their scholarships. Other women have been threatened with violence or suffered violence at the hands of those who would push them, coerce them into having an abortion. No woman should be forced to choose between her safety, between her scholarship, between her job, and having an abortion. Part 2 of my bill then makes it illegal to coerce a woman to have an abortion. The main thrust of my bill then is to protect women and to ensure that they are fully informed about this life and death decision. But do the laws have some effect to persuade a woman to choose life for her unborn child? The evidence is good that they do. Since abortions hit their all-time high in 1990 in the United States, there has been a gradual decrease in the number of abortions. The last year, 1.1 million abortions, 1.1 too many. But this was the lowest rate since 1974. In Missouri, our all-time high of abortions was 20,000 in 1980, 18,000 in 1990, and last year about 12,000. According to studies by the Heritage Foundation and other institutions, at least part of this decline is likely due to incremental abortion laws such as 1831. Well, I'd like to just conclude by sharing with you something Randy O'Bannon of National Right to Life said recently. What the pro-life movement has done and continues to do has saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Falling rates of abortion are a sure sign that, given truthful information about abortion, about its impact on their lives, about the child growing inside of them, and given even the slightest help and encouragement, many women will choose life. House Bill 1831, then, is a common sense measure to protect women and encourage them to choose life. I urge you all to choose life as citizens and as voters in the upcoming election. Thank you very much.
I guess if we had a speaker or a president of Pro Tem, they would hit the gavel and say, no clapping. I don't know whether you do it here or not. Bob, I can't help but start out this by telling you that before this started, we talked about our ages and our background. And I first came here as a student in 1968, which was before Roe versus Wade. It was also, I believe, about the year after that the birth control pill hit the street. And unfortunately, the pill back then didn't work as well as they do today. And myself and other friends of mine and people that I knew very, very well seemed to have unwanted pregnancies. And in those days, abortion was illegal. And women who had unwanted pregnancies had to choose illegal methods of having abortions. And that's where I don't want to go back to. I want to say that when I looked at your bill and read it and studied it, first of all, I have about 10 different constitutional and legal claims against your bill. I could spit them all out at you if you want me to.
But we really bore the audience.
But more than anything else, in addition to the analysis you used in Casey and Carhart, I want to say that I think this bill really falls outside of the that analysis. To me, what this bill amounts to is sex-based, gender-based stereotyping, discrimination. It involves ideological propaganda that is imposed upon a woman and invades the relationship between doctor, patient. I think when a doctor meets with a patient, that they should be allowed to talk about the procedure. They should have informed consent. Every medical procedure allows that. But to impose this ideological propaganda, I know that the cases have been going in the direction for some time to allow that, but I think that your bill goes overboard in that regard. I want to get to some of the ways it goes overboard in the beginning. But more important than anything, I think that this issue of gender-based stereotyping, it appears to me that the motivating factor of your bill appears to suggest that women are weak, that they are confused, and they can be coerced, and they can't be held responsible for their choices. I think that your bill suggests that the government needs to protect women to help them become mothers. And I think this whole issue of pregnancy is just a pretext that violates their right to enjoy personal responsibility. Having said that, I think it might be helpful to the audience to talk about what your bill does and the issues that I'm... What I want to do now is go through the provisions talking about them. One of the claims I want to make to you is that you, Bill, and you probably would have guessed this, but I think it's void for vagueness. And for those of you who don't know what that means, it means there cannot be a criminal statute if a person can't understand it. If it's ambiguous, it usually is held unconstitutional. In your bill, Bob, you talk about coercing, which is an act to cause a woman to seek or obtain an abortion. So she doesn't actually have to get an abortion. She just has to seek an abortion. And it has to be against her will. And that gets back to this whole issue of stereotyping. Some of the things that you had in your original bill is filed by you, and I think that's important to talk about because those are the principles that you thought custody, child support, roommates, and issues like that. Those are the issues that were in your bill originally that were taken out later on. But how do I know when I have, if I say to my wife, she comes in and tells me that she's pregnant, and I say twice, as your bill requires, I think you ought to get an abortion, I think you ought to get an abortion, and she goes out and just seeks an abortion, how do I know when I've made her do something against her will? There's a fine line here, and I don't know where to draw it. On one level, you have something that's constitutionally protected, to get an abortion. And on the other hand, you have something that's a criminal act. How do I know when that fine, where that fine line is? How do I know how to obey the law?
Well, some have asked, how can it be a crime to coerce someone to do something that's legal or constitutionally protected? And I would just respond to that. That's not exactly what you just asked, Ken, but it's close. I would just ask, well, it's legal to get into a car, but it's not legal to force someone into a car. But to qualify as the crime of coercing an abortion under my bill, one would have to force a woman to get an abortion by doing one of the things outlined in the bill, such as subdivision one, committing, attempting to commit, or conspiring to commit an offense that's already a crime elsewhere, abuse or stalking, an act of domestic violence, threatening to discharge an employee, threatening to revoke a scholarship, and that's the House substitute. And then the additional ones that were omitted in committee were threatening to file divorce and threatening to...
Okay, I want you to go over these custody. Real slow, because I want everybody here to understand what you're saying.
Well, what I'm saying is your example that you gave, if you advised your wife, I think you should get an abortion, that wouldn't fit under my bill as the crime of coercing an abortion, because that would just be a discussion you and she had. On the other hand, if you committed assault...
If I said, I think you ought to get an abortion, I think you should get an abortion, if you don't, I plan to divorce you. Under your bill, would that not be a crime?
Under my bill as filed, it would have been a crime. And I think here we're, I think that's deplorable behavior. I think what we're weighing when we were redrafting the bill in committee is protecting a woman versus bringing into court cases that are difficult because they occur in the context of a husband and wife discussing something in the context of their marriage, and that was eventually taken out of the bill.
Okay, now I have a constitutional right to be married or not to be married, isn't that correct? Isn't that substantive due process?
But you have a right to be married. You have a right to be married and not be married.
That's right. Not just a right, I have a constitutional right to decide when I'm married and when I'm not.
Yeah.
And so if my wife comes home and says she's pregnant by another man, and I say, I'm going to get a divorce if you don't get an abortion, then I become a criminal under your bill. And I have a constitutional right to divorce her.
Do you have a constitutional, some of the constitutional jurisprudence about substitute due process is a mess, and I disagree with a lot of it. But under Missouri law, you have a right to file for divorce.
Sure. Yeah, under United States Constitution, I have a right to file for divorce.
Well, I don't really see that in the Constitution, but I think
would agree that there's a long line of cases that have discussed what individual liberty is, and that particular one is something that the court has ruled on point. You have a right to decide when you're married and when you're not married.
Well, again, substantive due process is just another crazy thing. Of course, the court repudiated substantive due process in Lochner, and then we have this whole string of cases in this issue of social policy, abortion, and birth control, and so on, in which substantive due process has.
Well, I'm arguing that it's constitutional. Do you give me that if I, under the hypothetical that I just gave you, and I say that I want to get a divorce because she's pregnant by another man, and
you can get the divorce.
I can get the divorce, but I also go to jail.
You can get the divorce, but again, under the original bill, it would have been a crime to coerce her to get an abortion by threatening divorce.
You put me in jail, or other people in jail.
It would have been a crime in the original bill.
That's a yes.
I think we improved the bill in committee.
That's a yes.
I think we improved the bill in committee. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if we did, but I know somebody did. Let's go on to the next one. The other one is refusing, attempting to refuse, or threatening not to pay child support. Well, this is interesting to me because. Do you know what a Form 14 is?
I'm not familiar with it.
Rule 8801?
No, I don't.
Well, that's how you figure out who pays child support in a custody case. I've done many, many divorce cases and child custody cases, and according to this, before this child is born, before I have a legal obligation to pay child support, if I refuse, attempt to refuse, or threaten not to pay child support, that no judge ordered me to pay, I've committed a crime under your bill. Is that not correct?
Well, again, threatening not to support threaten not to pay child support would be to threaten to do something that is required of him under the law.
Not at this point. Let's go back to the hypothetical here. The same hypothetical. She comes in, she's pregnant by another man. I tell her, well, I think you should get an abortion. If you don't, I want to promise you, number one, I'm not going to pay you child support. Number two, I am going to file for custody of this child after I divorce you. And I'm going to win custody of this child. And you're going to have to pay me child support, which all of those things I have a constitutional right to do. But under your bill, you make it a crime.
Again, this was if you can really say any of these things, but to say either do this or either get an abortion or I will do these things. That would have been a crime under my law.
To vote on that and make that a law.
I think that because these give rise to a lot of potential he said she said type scenarios. That's why we took that out in committee, those particular provisions in committee. So I think the House committee that the substitute bill I think was an improvement. Not that it isn't deplorable behavior to do these things, to threaten a woman with these things if she doesn't get an abortion, but rather because it really invites a lot of the kind of messy interfamily litigation.
to interfere with the intimate relations between family members. I want to ask you a question. I know that this part was taken out of the bill. I hear you say now that you have, it sounds to me like you have some problems with it.
Well, I think many times, Ken, as a legislator yourself, things are in bills, and as you go through the process, you say, you know, given if I had it to do again, I would have changed this or removed this, and that's what happened with this bill.
I tell you, in the 22 years that I was in the legislature, I never ever filed a bill on abortion.
Did you ever amend a bill, Ken?
I've amended it a couple of
times. Yeah. Okay.
So, granted that this issue on I want a divorce, I won't pay you child support, I'm going to fight for custody, I'm going to withdraw financial support from you, I'm going to not let you live here anymore. You acknowledge at this point that those are unconstitutional provisions in the original bill.
No, I don't know that I acknowledge that they're unconstitutional, but I think out of a matter of prudence and to avoid dragging cases that are very difficult to prove, that are very messy, and that, as you say, interfere with these intimate relations between spouses. I think we did the right thing when we amended that bill.
Two questions. As a member of Congress, you would not introduce the bill the way you introduced it at the beginning of this legislative session.
I think the bill, as we went through the process, we made some good changes.
So that's a.
That's a yes. No.
You would not.
I would not.
Okay. And in the event that somebody else files your bill next year in the state legislature, would you go there and testify against it?
Oh, perhaps those couple of provisions that we were talking about. We're talking about three sentences of a 10-page bill, but sure, I think. And again, it's not a matter of constitution, but a matter of prudence.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to sleep easier tonight knowing that you're back on your original position. But since you have, I will be happy to move on to the next subject. The next subject that I want to talk to you about,
you want to do the subject and then maybe take some questions from the audience?
I'd kind of like to cover the two other provisions of your bill.
Sure.
Let's see, it's only 28. We've only been doing this about half an hour. I'd like to cover the two provisions. The other provision that I'd like to ask you about is this, what I call the predominant factor. Let me read to the audience and to you section 565.315.1. Any person who knowingly performs or induces or assists in performing or inducing an abortion with knowledge that the predominant reason the woman is seeking or obtaining the abortion is coercion, that person is guilty of a Class C felony. Now, and then in 565.315.3, you say in your bill, a physician who knows that the predominant reason is coercion, the woman can no longer give her informed consent. So,
what section was that?
565.315.1 and 565.315.3. So I think that this is another constitutional objection, because here is another clear example of someone not knowing how to obey the law. Hypothetical. Woman comes into the doctor and says, I want an abortion. And the doctor starts talking to her about it, and she says something to the effect of, I've had four children, I can't afford to really support the children that I have, my body's kind of worn out from having four children, having late in life, my husband is really, really, really mad and wants me to get this abortion. And Well, she says that, let's just say that she says, well, my husband really doesn't want me to have this abortion. I kind of want to have the baby in spite of all those other issues, but he really doesn't want me to, but all those other issues are a factor. The question that I have for you, doesn't that impose a chilling effect on doctors? Because if the predominant factor is that the coercion took place, then they're guilty of a Class C felony, which is 7 years in prison.
Well, again, this bill would only apply if, the doctor knows that it has to knowingly test that the woman is coerced into having an abortion. In your hypothetical, the woman would not be coerced.
Okay, how does the knowingly test really come into play? Now, let's just say, again, hypothetically, that there's a very aggressive pro-life prosecutor who wants to run for Attorney General of the state of Kansas, and he wants to make a name for himself, and he knows that there's a Planned Parenthood clinic down the street, and there's an abortion doctor in there, and some woman tells him that she had an abortion and spits out the same thing that I just shared with you, and he prosecutes. How does that doctor have to...
In your hypothetical, there was no coercion involved because the woman wanted the abortion. And that's the key. If a woman has a right to choose an abortion, she has a right to choose not to have an abortion.
Well, tell me what are the predominant factors. Were you involved in the workers' comp debate?
No.
Okay. That work was a big, big issue in that debate. And what that meant, predominant, what does the word predominant mean? Was very difficult, and to this day, lawyers are struggling over the meaning of that term. And they don't know, well, if there's two factors, does it mean 51%? If there's six factors, what does predominant mean? Does it mean 25%? It's the impact, the constitutional claim that I would make against your bill is that, number one, a doctor would not know what a predominant factor is, and therefore it would have a chilling effect on his willingness to perform an abortion, because if he's wrong or she's wrong, that doctor is faced with 7 years in prison.
Again, I think the factual question for a jury would be whether the woman expressed a desire to have the abortion, or she expressed the desire not to have the abortion. She wanted the abortion, she could have the abortion, and she's not coerced. If she is brought in, as there have been cases, dragged in, kicking, screaming, saying, I don't want the abortion, and he does it anyway, he does deserve to be guilty of the felony prescribed in this bill.
You think there's a lot of that happening out there?
I don't know that there's a lot of that happening there, but I believe that it's appropriate. This is an appropriate penalty when it does happen.
Now, you also say in your bill that if a physician who knows that the predominant reason is coercion, you take away the woman's constitutional right to have it.
No, if she's coerced, she doesn't want the abortion, and her constitutional right, which actually has been upheld in federal appellate court, to not have an abortion, kicks in. If she's coerced, she doesn't want to have an abortion, and therefore she has a right to not have an abortion, and my bill protects that.
The way your bill reads, she can't have one. She can be coerced. Someone could have held a gun to her head, and she may have walked in there scared to death and said, you know, the reason that I'm not getting this abortion is that someone held a gun to my head. And then she could have a full reflection of 24 hours, 48 hours, and come back. And
then she's no longer coerced.
That doctor is going to be chilled. Do you think that doctor wants to go to court and try to prove whether it was
believe me,
or not?
As a physician, if someone walked in one day and said, I'm only asking for this procedure, forget about abortions, because there's a gun to my head, and they come in the next day and say, I changed my mind that there's no gun, I might be suspicious. But if the facts are that she wants the abortion, she can get the abortion under Roe versus Wade and the progeny cases.
Under your bill, she can.
Because once she gives her free and informed consent, she's no longer coerced.
The doctor would have, under the circumstances that I described, the doctor would have to be willing.
He should be suspicious.
Well, he's suspicious.
When she comes in with the gun to her head, he should be calling the police. Of course, he should be suspicious. And then once the guy with the gun is in jail and she reflects on it a couple days, then she could decide whether she wants to carry her baby to term or
not, according to the way your bill reads. If you look at all the groups, all the women's groups who represent women's reproductive rights in this state, every single one of them thought that this would be
you mean industry groups like Planned Parenthood and their
I mean like women against domestic violence groups like Colleen Gold.
Colleen had some objections to it that
this was the objection that she had to it.
No, this wasn't.
Well, I'll tell you what I have over here. I have a press release from them saying that that's the objection.
Yeah, well, in that case, I disagree, just like I disagree with you, but I haven't seen that press release, Ken.
Yeah. Let me ask, when your doctor and when patients come in to you, does any predominant factor issues ever surface during the course of your decision of whether to perform a medical procedure?
Again, I think the issue is whether a patient's giving their free and informed consent. And if they're doing so, we do the procedure. If they're not, we don't do the procedure.
You know, see, this is why I think this is kind of sex-based discrimination. Because I think that most people will think that if a woman comes into an abortion clinic, like Planned Parenthood, she pretty well knows what the deal is. She knows she's pregnant. She knows she doesn't want to be pregnant. She knows she wants an abortion. And you place these little laws that have put a different requirement on this doctor performing this medical procedure than any other medical procedure that exists. Now, she knows what's going on, but it seems to me to suggest that you think that this woman is not capable of making up her mind and knowing exactly what she's doing.
Well, not at all. I think that in most cases, I assume it is the case that a woman walks into an abortion clinic asking for an abortion wants the abortion. But in some very specific cases outlined in this bill, and being threatened with loss of job, loss of scholarship, or other crimes outlined elsewhere in statutes, in those cases, if she's only seeking the abortion because of those things, no, her situation ought to be treated differently. The abortion clinic, the abortion doctor, shouldn't be complicit in the act of coercing the abortion, particularly when it's an example of a violent act, such as threatening.
But you think it's okay for the government to try to coerce her into not making up her mind, that she's not capable of making up.
No. You're really twisting this bill, Ken. The government does have a role in protecting the weak. And a woman who is being threatened, let's say, with an act of violence, an act of abuse, might need protection. And that's what my bill seeks to do.
Let me give you a hypothetical. This one strikes really close to home. I have a daughter, Jessica. She's 20. She goes to Lindenwood University. She is there on an advanced scholarship. I looked at her curriculum, and it's about 80% dance and about 20% book. Not particularly always happy with her choice of career choices, but she just won a national gold medal in dance about 3 months ago, and I'm really proud of her. But let's, another hypothetical. She comes to her coach and says, "Hey, coach, guess what? I'm pregnant." And the coach says, "Well, Jessica, that's great. I'm really happy for you. But honey, we gave you the scholarship to come here and dance, and you know, it wasn't us who got you pregnant. You went out there and did that on your own. And I don't know what the school's going to say, whether that scholarship is also, it's going to be available to you as opposed to some other girl who will actually be able to dance this year. And you knew that you're here to dance, and you know, so." Now, the way our meets are built, if Jessica decides that she has to get an abortion because she's going to lose that scholarship, then that coach and the school officials become criminals under your will.
They would already be doing something that's illegal under federal law, under civil federal law, if they discriminated against her on the basis of her pregnancy status. But again, in your hypothetical, they were just talking about, you know, it's going to be hard to dance while you're pregnant. That's very different than saying, get an abortion, or we're pulling your scholarship.
Well, what's the difference really if you say you won't have the scholarship if you're pregnant, as opposed to saying, you know, if you're not pregnant, if I get an abortion,
I don't think they can take the scholarship away.
That would be
inappropriate in either case. But the coercion always implies if you don't do this, if you don't have the abortion, then there will be these consequences.
I don't think there's an Abortion Protection Act that would protect our civil. But what I'm wondering is why you want to criminalize and put somebody in prison. I mean, don't you think that nothing can be
done? Well, once again, I think we need to get back to the point that threatening someone, unless they have a procedure like an abortion, is in itself a violent act. And I think in that case, criminal penalties to protect the woman.
I want to read to you your own definition of threatening. And to the audience here, threatening, under page 8, subsection 9, it says, threatening, two or more communications by any means, or a course of conduct that would cause a reasonable person to believe that the person is likely to act in accordance with the communication, or as implied by the course of conduct. And then it says, which is really crazy in my mind, threatening does not include constitutionally protected speech or any generalized statement regarding abortion, such as an emotional expression by a family or household member of the woman. So, two or more communications by any means or a course of conduct. So, you don't say in here that you have to say, Jessica, you have to get an abortion. You just have to engage in a course of conduct that would cause her to believe that she's going to lose her scholarship. And then her coach goes to jail.
No, that the person is likely to act in accordance with the communications. In other words, if the official said, "If you don't get the abortion, we will take your scholarship away from you,"
it doesn't say that. It says
no. That official would be the person likely to act in accordance with the communication.
No. No, it doesn't. That's not what it says. That's not what it says. Yeah, that's not how it interprets it.
The threat is when a person says, "If you don't do this, I'm going to act in a certain way," and that's.
But you have to define here, because I'm reading to you your own definition. So it is what it says, and you can call something else.
No,
it doesn't matter what law it is.
You're just misreading that. Well, Ken, I think.
But then, if I'm misreading it, before we.
It's 5 to 8, why don't we start to
Representative Bonder, I'll tell you something. As a member of Congress, that when you consent provision, you said earlier that all it does is inform the woman of her medical procedure, but doesn't really impose ideological speech and also provide her false and misleading information?
Absolutely not. It specifies what a woman has a right to know in the course of her making her decision whether or not to have an abortion. That would include information about the procedure, information about complications of the procedure. It would include the right to see her unborn child, if she so wished, with an ultrasound, the right to hear her unborn child's heartbeat. And in the case of a baby who is over 22 weeks gestation, it would include the right to receive information prepared by the state about the subject of fetal pain.
Representative Iorino and I know that after 22 weeks, a woman does not have a right to have an abortion longer.
Because oh, sure she does.
Only it affects her life or her health.
Her health, and that was, of course, the holding in Roe versus Wade. Of course, the companion decision of Roe versus Wade was Doe versus Bolton. Doe versus Bolton held that health included familial, psychological, financial, and emotional considerations. When it comes right down to it, when you read Roe versus Wade in the context of Doe versus Bolton, this right to abortion extends throughout all 9 months of pregnancy for almost any reason. If a woman wants an abortion in the 8th month of pregnancy and the abortionist is willing to do it, a health rationale can be formulated and that baby can be aborted.
Roe versus Wade and its companion cases and all the progeny that follow say that a woman has the right to have an abortion up until the child reaches viability, which means when the child can live on its own. And after that, she doesn't have a right to have an abortion unless her life or her health is affected.
Health, though, is interpreted as written in Bolton, which included psychological and social and financial well-being.
If a 12-year-old was a rape victim, I would assume that that would affect her health. Did you read Boynevich versus Ohio?
I'm not familiar with Boynevich
versus Ohio. Well, it was a 6-day trial. There was a case in there where there was a rape and incest victim, a 12-year-old girl. And she didn't know she was pregnant, so she went way past viability, way past 21 weeks. And the doctor in that case said, well, of course it would affect her psychological health. Of course it would have an impact on her, and decided that he would perform the abortion. Now, I know that people like yourself try to close that exception.
The court upheld the abortion in Boynevich.
It wasn't an as-applied case. It was over the issue of late-term abortions and using the impact gains PNF procedure.
Partial abortion.
That's a political term.
It's not. The baby is pulled two-thirds of the way out of the womb, and the legs are there, and they're inflailing, and you stick a trocar in the back of the baby.
I just had a partial birth abortion. There's a lot of boring procedures, but you call it.
Most doctors
refer to medical procedures under the terms that they're referred to in the medical terminology books. Now, that term has been politicized, but
you would like to
remove the health exception. Is that correct?
No, I believe the most common pro-life position is that we oppose abortion except when the life of the mother is in danger. Specifically, in Missouri law, we have an emergency section that talks in terms of imminent risk to life or to a or a situation in which a woman is imminently faced with something that could permanently damage a major bodily function. So I think the U.S. Supreme Court's definition of, quote, health is unfortunately so wide that a truck could be driven through it.
Like a 12-year-old pregnancy.
No. Someone late in pregnancy saying, you know, I don't want this because I don't think it'll be good for my psychological well-being and and I can't afford the baby, so I want it. So,
but the point is that no one is that you not support that.
Look,
that
I don't support the right to kill a baby in this
period.
Pregnancy, and it gets all the more heinous when it's done in a late pregnancy where babies are viable. Babies are saved at 22, 24 weeks these days, and you know, we're killing them in abortion clinics and hospitals around this
country. I really don't know, but in the case of rape and incest, would you not allow someone to choose?
You can. I don't believe in killing the baby for the crime of the father.
So the answer is?
I don't believe in killing the baby for the crime of the father, and yes, I don't believe in that. Thank you for that. Look, I don't think it's good for that girl. I don't think it's good for that girl to know that the baby that was living inside her was her daughter and killed. No, I don't think that's healing. In the treatment of
say that this debate has to take into discussion the reality that faces teenagers and even kids from 10 to 11 and younger in this country increasingly. It's obscuring the changing nature of the problem. And to obscure it is to abandon all of those who are in danger to that danger. And, you know, I know this debate is not about that process, but I really felt I wanted to raise it.
Well, you know, I'm glad you did. Hopefully, 1831, as you say correctly, doesn't have anything to do with human trafficking. Actually, another bill of mine, which did pass the legislature, both houses, House Bill 1549, which was the immigration bill, actually did have anti-human trafficking provisions within it. There's no question human trafficking is a horrendous problem. It's an international problem, and yes, even in this country, it's a problem, and I commend you for raising it. Thanks.
She's basically, I used an example in a case called Voinovich versus Ohio. It deals with late-term abortion. And it was trying to decide whether certain procedures were medically necessary or not. And the court got into it. This isn't my opinion. I'm just sharing with you what the court reasons. The court reasoned that the health exception for a post-viability abortion would include an incest victim of a 12-year-old girl. As I recall, the law in the state in Ohio was that her parents had to make that call for her because she was only 12. Now, of course, it wasn't the father who was the father of a child, as well as her father. It's an interesting, long case, a state trial. Certainly cares about this whole subject and tough reading.
Because there are a And so your bill attempts to protect those people. Now, what Ken is bringing up is that maybe it is articulated in a way that defines these things well enough. And so, you know, I don't know about that. But the reality is it depends on the piece of society that we're looking at that you're trying to protect. It's not that the suburbanite with two children and a cohesive family unit that decides to go over to Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood is one of the biggest issues in terms of profit carrying off these victims that there is. And so that's what the issue is, protecting people from the over-aggressive profiteering on these people that come in as victims of some pimp, somebody that's got control. It's the same as children are victims if they're abused in a family or if they're abused. So the purpose is good. One of the things I have a problem with, Mr. Order, I think that you personally are very serious about this. In my situation, I've been voting both parties because I am pro-life, and we've had 12 years of Republican Congress, both sides, and 8 years of presidency. And this issue every time traps us into voting Republican for that purpose, and there's a lot of wordplay and nothing ever gets done. And I basically, on the other hand, have a Democrat at heart as far as social and people issues, sustained issues for the middle class. And so this is my dilemma, and I really hate elections because I suffer.
I have very little patience for politicians who talk about things and don't get things done. I think you could talk about that in the abortion issue. You could talk about that with border security. You could talk about that about containing spending. But in the Missouri legislature, we have gotten a number of pro-life bills passed over the past decades. Honestly, even when Democrats were in control, and when there was a Democratic governor, there were enough pro-life Democrats who joined with pro-life Republicans to get pro-life bills done. So, although I share your frustration that more has not been done to protect human life on the federal level, I think at the state level, quite a bit has been done.
There are pro-life Democrats, and that to me is the idea.
Thank you.
Leave it up to the locals.
school board because they know best what's right for their children. And those are the people who elect them to run the schools, and so they should decide what kind of program schools will best educate their children.
And what do you think, Ken? About two more questions? It's about 15.
Maybe you could say something about something.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. I believe what Ken just said is that it, right now it is up to, in Missouri, it is up to the local school boards to decide whether to teach sex ed according to the federal abstinence guidelines versus the other approach. So I think most school districts now do have sex education programs, and I don't think the evidence is there that they work, but that doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't try. So
there's a lot of this. There's fun, but I'm sorry to jump in. There's a lot of federal funding that is given. If your school chooses to do abstinence only, you get federal funding. If your school chooses to do a comprehensive sex ed, you don't get that funding. Yeah. And there is a lot of statistics. And I am, as this man here, I am a pro-life Democrat myself. I would like to see abortions in as well.
Sure.
But comprehensive, and there are a lot of statistics, and comprehensive sex ed has been proven to work, where abstinence only sex ed still is, as Ken says, with people who have unwanted pregnancies. So
yeah, I would dispute some of that. It's obviously, there's many issues that there are studies that go both ways, but I've actually did spend a little time last year when we were debating House Bill 1055 on the floor of the House, debating that very issue, but yeah, that's it's an important issue, but thanks for your comments. Yes?
Yeah, I have kind of a follow-up to the gentleman's comment here. I'm kind of thinking forward about who's going to be in Congress.
Sure.
All right, so he was asking about, like, when you're elected and then what are you going to do? Okay, I'm assuming that you think that abortion should be illegal and that you think abortion is murder. So if that's the case, then I'm assuming that that's first-degree premeditated murder.
Well,
and how long would the woman have to go to jail for?
Well, I think we can go back to the state of our abortion laws prior to Roe v. Wade. And not a single state imposed a penalty on the woman who had the abortion. They imposed penalties on the physician, anywhere from losing the license to jail time. But no, I think that the woman who seeks abortion is in a very bad position, and I don't think any of the legislators pre-Roe wanted to punish her. But in my mind, the abortionist is a murderer. But generally the laws did not impose the first degree premeditated murder penalty. But I believe in many of the states, abortion was a high level misdemeanor or a felony.
You don't think the woman's a party to that crime? That's my question.
If we could tomorrow outlaw abortion in this state, I think I'd probably follow the pre-Roe laws that inflict certain penalties on the abortionist.
Well, I mean, like somebody who, like, I just think about the other things that are involved in, like, if you're, like, another kind of murder, like, there are ways to be an accessory to that murder. Like, you drive a getaway car, or you know that someone's intending to do it, you don't do something. Like, it seems like there could be a wide range of people who could be implicated, like a taxi driver. I mean, it could be, you know.
I think most of the laws punished the abortionist, and that's generally who I would target with the law if I were writing such a law.
I think if you write a law like that, you would run into some equal protections under the law. A woman who goes in and makes a decision to have an abortion, she pays a doctor to perform the abortion on her. The doctor goes he's filled with death. The woman walks away as some kind of a victim. I mean, that's treating women like they're not capable making this decision, and they make it all the time. And I don't think any law like that would hold up.
reasons in Roe versus Wade that it was the woman's right, not the government's choice, up until viability. I really don't know a better place to draw the line. Hopefully, through family planning and science, that someday unwanted pregnancies won't exist, and that would be my goal as a member of Congress to try to move us in that direction. But if we're all free, if the government can control a woman, then the government can control a man, and then really none of us are free. And so this is a very personal decision, unique to a woman, up until the time where that fetus cannot, or up until the point in time where the fetus can live on its own. I think that we should leave that choice with the woman, not with the government. Yes?
I'd like to address a level that I don't think you've spoken about a lot yet, and that is, we've spoken about the men more often than the women involved in this situation. Not much have you addressed the issue of the child. However, I'm getting a sense that you have distinct attitudes about this child. I'd like to probe into that a little bit, and I want to point out the few particulars about this bill which you initially mentioned. One, that the nature of the procedure would be explained to the woman with some specificity so that she have a better understanding of this very stressful situation. Perhaps there's some duress involved. Clarify the thing that is what it is she's getting herself into for a $300 proceeding. Also, the potential health risks that she could face in making a decision, perhaps without giving a lot of reflection. Information about the gestational progress of her child, perhaps assisted by an ultrasound test that would introduce her to the child within her. And then alternatives to this situation, and a one-day period of reflection. I believe, Dr. Andre, I think I perceive that you know very well the consequence of providing these kinds of information and services to a woman will have the effect of, in many cases, causing her not to abort and causing many more children to be born. And I think that's really what you are concerned about. If you will admit that, I think that's the case. I would like then for Mr. Jacobs to outline what your particular objections are to providing the women with that kind of information and why you seem to be in more of a hurry, if you will, to get this decision made. Well, how does this reflect your various ideas or thoughts about the child here, not just the woman?
I think that at any time that a person goes in to see their doctor, that doctor has the education, the sensitivity to the person to explain the situation to them. And the law currently requires informed consent. What we have with Representative Hines' bill is 6 pages of legal requirements imposed on the doctor. I think that interferes with the doctor-patient relationship. Instead of the doctor just dealing with the medical condition of the patient, we have the state's ideology imposed upon the person there. And, you know, people may not want to hear what the government has to say. They may want to hear what the doctor has to say. We are compelling speech on the part of the doctor. Now, in no other situation does the state impose 6 pages of requirements, video, colored videos and colored pictures. A woman may come in for an abortion at 14 weeks, but this bill requires photographs of the gestational period of every 2-week period. It also requires the doctor to talk about child support. Well, doctors, this doctor doesn't know about Form 14 and Rule 88.01. He'd be engaged in the
practice of law. So I think the issue is we need to preserve the doctor-patient relationship, because that is a very private thing, and try to keep the government out of it as much as possible. Now, I know that the government regulates medicine, but I know I don't have time to do that, but if I went through all six pages of all the things that are imposed here, I think we really do debate on that very, very private relationship with the doctor patient.
Would you also agree that carrying out the procedures involved in the explanations of those six pages of explanations and alternatives, that the consequence would be that many fewer babies would be killed?
I
does that matter?
I think that a doctor has a responsibility to provide medical treatment to the woman. I don't think the doctor has a responsibility, and I know how obviously strongly you feel about it. And even if I didn't believe that it was the woman's choice, not the government's, I don't want the government telling my doctor what to tell me. I want my doctor to tell me what he or she wants to tell me, not the government. I think I'll be better off if the government stays out of it.
This raises a couple of very good questions. The first is there the chance that some of this information might persuade a woman to choose life rather than death for her unborn child? And Planned Parenthood v. Casey and then Ms. Osby last year explicitly acknowledged that that is permissible, and if that happens and more babies are given the chance to live, in my mind, that's a good thing. But another important question that this raises is, why should the government, as Ken would, I think, put it, intervene in the doctor-patient relationship to dictate precisely what should be part of the informed consent discussion? Now, by the way, some of these things, like the child support stuff, that's in a form prepared by the Department of Health, not the doctor. But the reason, the answer to that, why you're getting specific about what needs to be in this informed consent process, is at present, the informed consent process in abortion clinics is a joke. And when I say that, let me point out that a major abortion clinic in the city of St. Louis, if you go to their website, or at least if you went to their website 2 weeks ago, you would find that a woman is instructed to download a form, print out the form, and there's an informed consent checklist. And that informed consent list asks the woman to certify that she has discussed the abortion procedure and all these things on the checklist with, quote, a treating physician. Now, the woman's to sign that form and bring the form into the abortion clinic. That form doesn't even ask the name of the physician. It doesn't ask whether that physician has any expertise or knowledge of obstetrics or gynecology or fetal medicine. The clinic doesn't even want to know who that doctor is. There's not even a pretense that might be the abortionist who is to perform the procedure. I think it's a joke. I think the form is just a way of getting around Missouri's affirmed informed consent law, so we need to strengthen our informed consent law, put some teeth in it, and that's why we need this bill.
And I would respond that Representative Onger wants the government to impose which doctor informs the woman.
Yeah, the doctor doing the procedure.
Well, the woman may want to choose her own doctor rather than the other doctor. She's smart enough to choose the doctor of her choice.
Well, no. If you choose a surgeon to remove your appendix, you get the informed consent from that doctor. The doctor doesn't hand you a form and say, go have some other doctor tell you about this.
The current law allows the woman to go to her private physician for consultation. You dictate. Now, the doctor still, who performs the procedure, still has to get the informed consent.
Exactly.
You dictate that she has to go there and don't permit her to go to her own medical.
Thank you. 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 Thank you.
if her own doctor's doing the abortion, he can do the informed consent. But this form is just a way of getting out of any kind of informed consent discussion.
You know,
it's on the website, and I heard the testimony to me.
So,
yes.
Yes, I'm surprised we don't agree on a lot of things. If we were wanting to protect, if we had a bill was filed to protect pregnant women, who might be more vulnerable than other women, that would be one thing. But this bill is designed, supposedly, to protect pregnant women who are seeking or who have obtained an abortion, even after the fact. I mean, they could already have the abortion after the fact, and it comes into play.
But if they're divorced, aren't you for that? I mean,
pardon me?
Aren't you for protecting a woman that's found to have been divorced and she did something?
I think that if the woman goes in there and signs an informed consent, and after discussing it with her doctor, that she is capable of making up her own mind on this. I don't think, neither does the statewide agency that protects women who are victims of domestic violence. They were all opposed to this bill, strongly opposed to this bill.
You know, I've heard people talking about women who are weak and distraught and don't have anywhere else to go, and so they turn to the abortion clinic as a last resort. And if that's the case, my heart goes out to any woman that's in that situation. But I've been a counselor for 17 years, and I've had occasion to talk with many women who have had abortions and talk with them about that experience. And I, the vast majority, didn't appear weak to me about that. And, you know, some of them had coercive people and coercive situations affecting them and around them, but they were able to incorporate those things in their decision on whether to have an abortion. And they felt confident that they made the right decision. And I think, you know, I'm not hearing any respect for the woman to be able to make those decisions. And I've talked to many women, and I respect that they made the right decision for themselves.
And if they, you know, were able to get through the difficulties of their situation, and they nevertheless freely chose to have an abortion, this bill wouldn't apply to them.
Even if someone coerced them.
Well, again, it's only if they were successful at coercing.
With coercion, you can coerce someone to say something, say, yes, I want this abortion. So I don't see how your bill would really work in that situation, because most people, if they're fearful of abuse or something, they're not going to say, well, I've kind of been coerced. They're just going to say, yes, I want it, if that's what's going to do. So I don't see how your bill would actually help women if that's the goal.
Well, sure. If a woman comes in to the abortion clinic and says, I want this abortion, I freely consent to it, and they hide something that's going on, again, the bill wouldn't be able to remedy that situation.
And Mr. Jacob, I have a couple questions for you. First of all, I don't see how you're lumping in the murder of an unborn child with just any other medical procedure, because I just don't see the twisted logic in that. Second of all, you said earlier something to the effect of,
is that a question?
How are you doing this? Second of all, you said something earlier about when a woman goes into an abortion clinic that you're assuming, okay, they already know what they're getting into. If it's a 19-year-old, a 20-year-old, you know, teenager, I'm 19, I know that a lot of teenagers don't do a whole lot of research on whatever they're doing. If I was going to go into a hospital for some procedure, I wouldn't know everything about it. I'd expect the doctor to teach me something. Since when do Democrats oppose education?
I don't think what they're getting is education. That's the problem. I think what they're getting is state-imposed ideology. And I think that this...
How is being shown an ultrasound ideology? It's an ultrasound.
If you take one of the requirements alone and say, is this okay? Well, then I might say that that's okay. And in fact, every woman who has an abortion gets to see an ultrasound right now. So I don't know that that's really an issue. But when you take all six pages and throw it all in and impose that upon the woman, I think that, again, interferes with the relationship between the woman and her doctor.
Aren't there other, there's regulations for other operations?
Well, there are regulations, and I would say those regulations need to apply here. But what he's proposing are six pages of regulations that don't apply.
So basically, you're saying, okay, we don't need any regulations on abortion?
No, I didn't say that at all. There's plenty of regulations on abortion. There's way more regulations on abortion than by far any other medical procedure, by far. But Representative Onder and others keep wanting to add to these regulations to the point where you end up possibly delaying the woman's decision, putting her at medical risk. The information that is required to be presented to the woman don't apply necessarily to that particular woman. They may apply to a different woman, but not to her. That's the doctor's job to do that. The doctor has to meet with his patient, or her patient, and decide what's appropriate. The current laws right now are satisfactory. Every year there's an effort to add more and more and more on, and at some point it's not accurate medical information, it's not truthful medical information, it becomes state-imposed ideology, and that's wrong. It's wrong for the state to interfere in the doctor-patient relationship.
Can I challenge you to show me any information that I call from this bill that's medically inaccurate?
Well, just the requirement of showing these photographs of these two-week gestational age every 2 weeks. It may be that the woman is only 13, 14 weeks pregnant, and to show her pictures of the fetus from birth, or from conception to birth, doesn't really apply to her.
Is it medically inaccurate, though?
It's not relevant to her.
It shows her the continuum of medical life throughout pregnancy.
It's misleading to her.
It's misleading to her to show her what a 30-week gestation baby is?
Why do it?
So you have an amendment to my bill, and you just cut out the pages after she has that gestation.
Actually, if you want to spend more time, you're the one who cut me off of this section. What I have is an entire list of everything that your bill imposes. And I think if I read that entire list to everybody here, they will understand that this no longer is medical information. It is state-imposed ideology that interferes with the doctor-patient relationship.
I went through the information in that statement, and it's medically accurate information, and all of it is specifically challenging for
you. You didn't come close, not even close, and you know this, to sharing with everybody everything that will be required of the doctor.
Angel,
if you want me to go through it,
yes,
I have all this. Six pages, right? Six pages worth of stuff.
The informed consent.
Yeah, six
pages. Just part of the six pages.
Listen, you tell me. Everything on this page, everything on this page, this page, this page, and this page, and this page, and this page, and finally to here. All of that is imposed.
And, you know, it's one-size-fits-all information to a woman. And it's not unique to that particular woman.
It's nature of procedure. It's risks and benefits.
It's
complications.
It's all information. There's all these alternatives. If she goes out and has the
are
child...
Are you saying she shouldn't be told that there's availability of child support?
You know, even
you're saying we need cradle to grave socialism before we can do anything.
Socialism, it is you by having the government impose on doctors what they tell their patients.
Okay, and that's just forcing this particular industry where things have been particularly abusive to live up to ordinary standards of care.
No one thinks it's abusive, but those people who share your ideology. The other side thinks it's only an abusive person if there's a woman in trouble in a bad situation who has an unwanted pregnancy, and here comes Representative Onder, and her problems just got worse.
And I'll show you these informed consent forms, and if you really think that an informed consent discussion happened before these things get signed, I'd be very surprised.
I've been debating this issue for a long time. The CASA decision has been around for a long, long time. I'm familiar with the information that's provided to women, and I feel that the information is given by their doctor. They are completely informed, and they are completely capable of making their own decision without you imposing your own private ideology upon them.
Apparently, you've never spoken to or counseled post-abortive women. You have a very different view of this.
I spent 12 years as a therapist in this town working with young women. I guarantee you that I have had much more experience dealing with women who've had unwanted pregnancies in my professional life than you have. I believe you're an allergist.
I've been involved in crisis centers as well.
And this is one of the crises that they dealt with, so I had a very good experience.
Yeah, and...
Excuse me, Miss Ma'am.
Excuse me. We were talking about a criminal penalty imposed on a doctor for not knowing what the predominant factor of abortion is. We are now talking about the informed consent provisions. It is a totally different issue.
I think we all know this is a problem.
Well,
in the room. But the baby, as the gentleman just asked, it was, his question was not answered. Why is the emphasis put upon the baby than the doctor and the criminal procedure? Because everybody knows that at the end of that procedure, there is one dead person. There may be two, but we know there's one.
Everybody except the women that you counseled didn't realize they were getting an abortion.
Do you actually think that women, when they go in there, they really don't know what they're doing?
No, I think they do. But they're being told by Planned Parenthood many times that it is not a baby.
Well, Planned Parenthood doesn't drive women to the center. They drive there usually by themselves.
And I just would ask, why the objection to women getting this information?
Okay, I just wanted to know how your bill did in Congress and what the margin was.
Yeah, my bill passed by a vote of 113-33. Wow. Thank you. Every Republican who voted and quite a few members of Senator Jacobs' party voted for my bill. Thank you.
The bill died in the Senate, and there's a quote here I have from the Senate President Pro Tem, who's a Republican, who's pro-life, and he said that it died because some people had concerns about the legality of the coercion. And let me tell you how bills pass in the House. I don't know if you know. Basically, a bill's brought up, and the majority party allows it to be discussed for maybe 15 minutes, and then they
3 hours in my case.
And then they move to the previous question, and then that's it. If they only talk about this bill for 3 hours, I can promise you that was not enough time.
And
because
a couple hours in committee, and a good number of members of your own party voted.
I'm sure they did. And, you know, the Constitution exists to protect, and Bill of Rights exists to protect the rights of the individual, the majority and the government should not dictate the freedom and liberty interest of the single person.
That is true, and by the same token, liberal activist judges shouldn't make up new rights in a Constitution out of whole cloth. It's quarter to nine. Why don't we take one more question and maybe...
How about the gentleman in the long hair up there? He's been at 10 o'clock for a long time.
Well, I actually have a question. This is actually appropriate. I just want to thank both of you for making that. I know you go on and on. But I want to thank both of you for being here. I enjoyed hearing both of your opinions.
Thank you very much for coming, and have a great evening.